You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. This is premium content for October 13th, 2019. This is your host, Stephen Novella. This episode is an extended interview with developmental psychologist Bruce Hood discussing his new book, Possessed: Why We Want More Than We Need. As always, thanks to our premium members and patrons for their continued support of the SGU. We are joined now by Bruce Hood. Bruce, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hi, guys.
And Bruce is a developmental psychologist who we've had on the show before, the author of many excellent books. And we're talking to you now about your latest book, Possessed: Why We Want More Than We Need. So this is not about demonic possession. This is about owning stuff. Why do people like to own stuff?
Wait, this is a problem?
That looked around.
Yeah.
So tell us about your research. How did you get involved with this question?
Well, I've been interested in our unusual relationship with physical objects for some time now. Some of my early work on the supernatural thinking and the magical thinking was the way that we have peculiar reactions to objects which we think are possessed by demons or the evil essence of murderers. So I did that stunt many years ago, asking people to put on a cardigan and then say, would you still put on the cardigan if you knew it was it belonged to Jeffrey Dahmer or something like that? Everyone reacts in a very bizarre way. So I've been very interested in the way that we have this relationship with objects and possessions. And that kind of developed into a kind of appreciation that these are things which are an extension of ourselves in many ways, or other people. So we see personal possessions as not just being kind of, you know, unconnected to the owner, but actually having a deeper psychological connection. That's why we like memorabilia, why we value original, authentic items which have a very close connection with people we admire, and conversely, why we don't like to come into close contact with things which we feel might be contaminated. And so when I started to look more about this kind of work, I mean, I was researching where does it start from, where does it begin, and I was very interested in children's first attachment objects, so the teddy bear blankets. And so I started to do some research with Paul Bloom at Yale, and we were looking at this notion of authentic objects. And it comes down to this idea that there is this essence that we attribute to things which makes something irreplaceable or unique. And that's why we value original works of art rather over, you know, things which are identical or indistinguishable physically. So we have this kind of deep psychological connection with our possessions to the extent that actually part of who we are is kind of extended into all our personal possessions and our wealth and things that we own. And this was a point made by William James, one of the kind of fathers of psychology, the American psychologist who said that, you know, the self, who you are, is not just your body and mind, but everything that you can claim possession over. So this is really the premise of the book, is where does this come from? How does this manifest in different cultures? What is property? Because it's something that we just assume and we don't even think about it. But actually, when you start to look about property and ownership and the rights of access, you suddenly realize that your whole life is controlled by laws. So laws of ownership, laws of property. And your whole identity, to some extent, is in the physical extension of the things that you own. But I also address in the book, and this is, I think, a really interesting new territory, is how are these things changing now that the digital revolution is changing the nature of books and recordings and things. So it's a really broad strokes approach looking at the whole relationship humans have with objects, why we accumulate things, what compels us to want things we don't really want in the first place, and what's going to happen in the future.
So what are some of the basic components of this concept of ownership that first click into place with young kids?
Well, I think in the book I briefly talk about the way that children start to appreciate the way that they can control the world around them, literally young babies, okay? So they start off pretty metaphorically immature, but they kind of learn to pick up rattles and bang things. And so they start to learn the contingency of their actions. And control is actually one of the fundamentals of ownership because, you know, if you suddenly lose control of your body, for example, and you're a neurologist, so you'll know these conditions where people suddenly have this alien hand syndrome, it suddenly belongs to someone else. It's not theirs. So I think the primeval origins, if you like, of ownership is this appreciation of the contingency of your actions and the control of the world around you. And of course, when you don't own something, that's exactly the point, that you know you can't control it or it's taken away from you. So babies start off literally interacting with the world and banging rattles and sticking things in their mouths and teddy bears and all that stuff. But as they grow up, they learn that they have access to some things, but not others. So, you know, initially babies are prevented from touching things which are potentially dangerous for them. But as they get older, they say, no, you can't have that. That's your brother's. Or you can't have that. That doesn't belong to you. So they have to learn to understand the rules that not everything is open access. There are some things that they can, you know, they can own and some things belong to other people. And then they kind of have to work out the rules. Like who owns what, who's likely to own what. So you might think, well, that's kind of straightforward. But, you know, again, we're talking about very young children here. How do they figure out, you know, whose bag that is or whose wallet that is and so on? So there are these kind of fundamentals, like if someone's holding it, they're likely to be the owner as opposed to a thief. So there's some basic principles of ownership that children seem to appreciate quite early on, literally, you know, 2 to 3 years of age. But even that, you know, that develops with experience and develops with cultures, because not all cultures operate with the same rules of ownership. So I talk about, for example, in the book, the last hunter-gatherer tribes, which are left on the planet, the Hadza of Tanzania. They don't really have the same concepts of ownership that we operate with in the West. So for them, you don't really own anything. You can be in possession of it, but if you're not using it, I can help myself to it. So that's like going over to your neighbors and then borrowing their lawnmower if they're not using it, just taking it. So, well, you're not using it, so I'm going to use it. And that turns out to actually be a very optimal way of thinking about ownership when you're a hunter-gatherer tribe, because you can't carry a lot of stuff around with you. And so you have to really kind of you have to optimize the usage of things. And it turns out there's been some very interesting studies looking at the emergence of early civilizations and the success of these hunter-gatherer tribes. And they would have had to have had this kind of principle we call demand sharing, where no one actually owns anything outright. It's just a case of, you know, what's good for the group.
Yeah, so you talk about that as well, the fact that not that them as a specific example, but also different cultures have different concepts and strengths of ownership. And so it seems then, therefore, that the concept of ownership may not in and of itself be fundamental and universal, but maybe is a manifestation of something deeper, like some deeper psychology. Ownership is just one manifestation of that, and it's very culturally dependent how that manifests. Did you have researchers been able to dig down deeper as to what like the sources of ownership are?
Well, I think I start off by discussing the idea of competition. So obviously one goes to Darwin and talks about natural selection, and obviously you know, there's competition between individuals of a species, and so they will compete for resources, territory, mates, food, and so forth. And so that's kind of one basic principle of ownership, which is if you're holding on to it, it's mine, and therefore I have to fight you for it. But ownership is different in the sense that that's a convention, and that operates with kind of third-party punishment. So if we are a member of a group and we recognize ownership, then we understand that even though the owner isn't present, he may have gone off to fight a battle or raid the next village, he still owns the property, so we can't help ourselves to it. And if we do, then we can suffer the consequences of it. Animals don't tend to do that, okay? So if they abandon a territory or they abandon food or whatever, then the next person can just help themselves to it. So they understand possession and that you have to fight for what you have, but the concept of ownership is a convention that really people have to agree upon. And that's what that requires policing and laws. And that would have emerged presumably probably quite early in human development. But I think it really got amplified when we settled down and formed communities. So rather than being hunter-gatherers always on the move, now when you develop agriculture, you start to collect resources, you domesticate animals, you domesticate crops, you start to have reserves. And these need to be protected, and you need to go off on battles and warring parties, but you want to come back and make sure that your homestead is protected. And then, of course, this also allows you to become the establishment, to build up hierarchies of wealth, and then to pass that on as inheritance. So now resources in terms of crops and food and money is starting to appear now. These are things which can form transactions and be used and passed on to you know, to give advantage to your offspring and your siblings and all the people that you want to advantage. So it will have been some form of possession will have been there very, very early on, as it is with primates and other animals. But the convention of ownership, I think, is actually requires cognitive machinery to kind of work out the, you know, who owns what and what are the consequences to almost predict the course of action. So that's kind of sophisticated. And there's very little evidence that you see third-party punishment in animals. There's some reports that corvids, crows, you know, these guys are very clever, the feathered apes, as they're sometimes called, they may do something like that, but you don't see a lot of very good evidence that there's this third-party punishment. And yet you see it in human children by about 3 to 4 years of age.
Yeah, and even Jay and I have both raised kids, right? And Jay's younger daughter, who's 3 now, but even, you know, previously, she will take something, whether it's hers or not, and she'll look at you and go, this is mine. Like, she totally knows that. And she seems like, I have to assert my ownership over this.
Oh, yeah.
To the adults in the room. Like, that's a concept that comes in very, very early. But still, that's not too early to be learned, right?
No, no. And you're right. And that's actually one of the most common words. You know, mine is one of the first words that children learn. And so what they appreciate is that possessions are a form of dominance and status. And, you know, not over 90% of the conflicts in nurseries and playgrounds are over toys and possessions. And very often, it's the acquisition of the possession which is the goal, not the actual possession. So, you know, a child might fight for a toy, go and take it from another child, and then once they got it, they'll ban it, and then go after another child's toy. So this is how you establish dominance. And this is not, you know, it's not too dissimilar to, you know, primates do the same thing as well. So there are these hierarchies. We use possessions as a way of signaling status, and that's no different. We grew up like that in the West. And, of course, that's not the case in all cultures. So I think there is there's a need to establish acceptance, and there's a need to not be ostracized, and that could be in the form of establishing status. But that, in other cultures, that's also manifest by how well you integrate with others, so they're more interdependent. That's not to say that they don't have hierarchies, they're just not the same structures that we have.
Yeah, so status and being successful in your society are the real goals. The possession's just a means to an end, and that's culturally dependent.
That's right, and that's why I call it social peacocking. So, you know, in the animal kingdom, Darwin was really confused by adaptations, which seemed to be so inefficient. So why did the peacock evolve such a ludicrous, you know, display? It's really expensive, it's cumbersome, requires a lot of metabolic resources. That means the birds can't effectively fly. Well, this is because of a process, in addition to natural selection, called sexual selection. So the males typically compete against each other because of the imbalance between the number of potential sperm that a male can produce relative to the cost of raising an egg for the female. The males literally can have many more children. So they compete with each other for the attention of the females. The females, on the other hand, they have to choose the males who have the best genes. So what happened was a war of attrition in terms of advertising your genes. As Darwin said, they developed ornaments and ornaments. So this is the horns and the coloring. And that's why the males in the animal kingdom are the most colorful and show the bizarre displays, because these displays are markers for good genetic prowess. And in the case of the peacock, it's true. The elaborate nature of that peacock tail is a direct marker of the genetic immune system. So we know that those with impoverished tails tend to have poor immunity. So in a sense, it's a proxy for genetic fit. Now, of course, humans also developed adaptations to make us more or less attractive to females, and vice versa. Females also developed adaptations which are attractive to males. But we also had technology. We could also accumulate wealth. Again, this signals the advantages that you would have if you mate with me, if I've got all these resources. And that hasn't changed, of course. And that's why it's not just the beauty of the Ferrari or the fact it's it's such a wonderful piece of engineering. It also signals a big way up how good your status is. So this is what we call social peacocking. And in another sense, it's also the basis of what we call conspicuous consumption, that people buy and display luxury things. Yes, they're better made goods, and they may last longer. But a big factor in it is you're showing off to other people just how successful you are.
Bruce, tell us about the concept of endowment and what that tells us about ownership.
Yeah, now endowments, and I have been doing some research on this, because this is getting back into the irrational nature that we value certain objects more than other ones. And it turns out that when objects come into your possession, you immediately, assuming you've got a pretty good sense of self-worth, you start to think your stuff is worth more than anyone else is willing to pay for it. So, I mean, that makes a lot of economic sense, that you should always trade and ask more than others and try and buy things get a deal on something. But there's a psychological process where as soon as you take ownership of it, you value it more. Now, this was established by Daniel Kahneman and Richard Thaler, both recipients of the Nobel Prizes in economics. They had both worked on this phenomenon, looking at this imbalance between the price that people are willing to sell things off at and the price that others are willing to buy them at. And part of the explanation is to do with what's called the prospect theory. And this is what Kahneman got the Nobel Prize for. And this is the idea that the prospect of a loss weighs more heavily in your mind than the prospect of a gain. So you're always going to bias yourself to make sure you're not losing by asking more for your resources. But another component of this is actually the extent to which that object is part of your identity. And this is why traders, for example, people who do this for a living, they're not as emotionally invested in their products as novices. And so they show less of an endowment effect. And we've been looking at this in children, showing that if you induce an endowment effect in a child by basically getting them to think about themselves or make pictures about themselves, their possessions are the objects that they have. They start to value them more. So we did this really cool experiment where we gave children, first of all, a test to see if they could work out the relative value of these toys. And some of them were really good toys and some of them were a bit rubbish. We used a scale, a smiley face scale. And so the bigger the smile, the more they liked the object or they thought it was good. And if it was frowning, they didn't think it was very good. So once they used the scale, it was a way that they could kind of work out the relative value of these toys. Now, these are three-year-olds. This is well before the endowment effect turns up naturally, which is usually about at least 7 to 8 years of age. So having established they can use the scale, we then give them two identical spinning tops. Okay, so these are two little plastics things that you might get out of, McDonald's or something like that. And we asked them, well, how much do you think these are? How much do you like these guys? And they put them on the same point of scale. So that means that they understood at this point, these two identical things are equivalent. And then we did the thing is we gave them one of the toys, the spinning tops, and the experimenter took the one themselves. Then we did the manipulation. We got them to draw a picture about themselves and talk about themselves, or we got them to make a picture of their friend or talk about their friend, or we had a third controlled condition where they just made a farm scene. After they'd spent some time kind of being primed to think about themselves, someone else, or a farm scene, we then got them to evaluate the two identical tops again. And the children who had been primed to think about themselves, they thought that their top was worth much more than the experimenter's top, but the effect was not seen in the other two conditions. So that fits with this idea that as soon as you're kind of thinking about your possessions, then you start to value them more. And by the way, this was a study which was based on an adult study done with people from Hong Kong, done by William Maddox, and a really cool study where they got Hong Kongers to think either as Westerners or to think of themselves as Chinese because they have dual nationality. And when they think of themselves as Westerners, they show the endowment effect. But when they saw themselves as being more collectivist Chinese, the effect was more reduced. So in a sense, the endowment effect is this manifestation of this extended self concept, the idea that our possessions are somehow, you know, an extension of who we are. And if we have this kind of self-opinion, then we think our stuff is worth that much more.
What is this thing with our cell phones? I'm sure people must have asked you. It's really weird. So I've seen this happen with a ton of people, particularly my brother Bob, where he absolutely freaks out when he thinks he doesn't know where his phone is or he's lost track of his phone.
Well, I mean, the phone has become an extension of who we are. It's a main conduit of communication, is it not? You know, within your pocket, you have access to the total sum of world knowledge collected over the millennia. If you think about it, you know, the internet is through your cell phone. You can get any song, any picture, anything. So we spend more and more of our time on our phones, and we've almost offloaded a lot of our mental load onto our phones. If you think about, I don't remember telephone numbers anymore.
Yeah.
Directions, everything I've just offloaded into the digital era. And so they literally are an extension of yourself. And if you next time you're on a subway, you know, people are just looking this little thing in their own hands. They're doing everything through their phones. And this has people concerned, you know, because we've lost the art of communication, spontaneous speaking to other people. And, you know, it gets to the point when you're walking down the street that you feel it's full of people having schizophrenic hallucinations because they're talking out loud until you realize that they're obviously connected to the phone that you can't see. But yeah, I think the phone has become, has entered into our lives and changed it in ways which are really quite significant. And it's actually a major concern for us in the university sector, because they spend all their time on the phones, even in the lectures. So I actually have just started a course where I've banned the use of laptops and phones and trying to get the students to pay attention to what I'm saying again. So I suppose it's just this kind of deep insecurity that we feel if we don't have access to all that information. I think I would be the same, to be honest, because I certainly can't remember all my passwords for various things, and certainly telephone numbers and so on. So yeah, the phone has taken over our lives.
Yeah, that reminds me, a friend of ours, when he first got his smartphone, called it My Precious after Lord of the Rings. And when you think about it, the ring in Lord of the Rings was this ultimate manifestation of a possession being an extension of yourself. It literally became an alter ego. So I wonder, it's just interesting that it seems to go along with the psychology that you're talking about.
Oh, Steve, that is so scary what you just said. Because, I mean, think about how pathetic Gollum was.
Yeah.
And what it did to him. But, Bruce, do you get into anything in the book about the detriment of this, the glut of ownership, like the psychological damage it does?
Well, the thing is, there's a very obvious problem with overconsumption, and we're seeing the consequences of that with climate change. The major contributor to climate change is consumption, consumerism in one form or the other. So not just products. I mean, also taking flights and holidays, just the transport system, moving this stuff around the globe is one of the major problems. It's not simply coal furnaces and so on. So there's that issue. But I think the more fundamental problem is that people are generally not satisfied with accumulating more and more things because of the so-called hedonic adaptation. So we are motivated to acquire things, and we get a real thrill out of buying and consuming. And that's been stimulated in many ways, partly by the psychology of advertising, how we are led to believe that we will be happier if we have more and more things. But the mind adapts very, very quickly. And so once you've got something, you soon lose the interest in it. And of course, you've got some people who are pathological shoppers who just keep, they buy things and they never open them up. They're still in the packaging. But it's the acquisition which is what's really driving the motivational system in the brain, the pursuit of something. And this fits into work by Brian Knutson and others who've shown that the dopaminergic system, the reward systems, are really the ones driven by the acquisition, the pursuit, not the acquisition. So that's one of the problems. And then, of course, you have at the other end people who can't throw anything away. Now you're getting into the hoarding phenomenon, which is people who have, a pathological endowment effect, that the thought of losing or throwing anything away is so abhorrent that they just hold on to everything. So literally, you can't really be that happier with all the more stuff you get. You may be in the first instance, but soon you get used to it. And there's that really interesting study done again by Daniel Kahneman, the economist, and the other economist, Angus Deighton. And they were looking at the relationship between income and success and happiness. And yeah, nobody wants to be poor. And actually having more income is good. It makes you feel better. But once you reach a level around about $75,000 to $80,000 per annum, having more income doesn't actually make you any happier. You do feel more successful because you can see the trappings of your wealth. You can see the luxury car and the big yacht and all that. But in terms of your subjective happiness, it doesn't really match the same pattern. So you do tend to be happier with more money, but not as much as people think. So we kind of aspire to own more things. We're told by advertising that we are inadequate unless we have the latest, greatest things. And this, I think, preys on our need for status, going back to what I was saying earlier on, that we want to be seen to be successful. But a purely materialistic view of the world, I think, is misguided. And, as that cartoon, I don't know if you've seen it, but the man on his deathbed comes up with a final statement saying, "I just wish I bought more crap."
Yeah.
I don't think that, when you think about, for most people, that is really, their goal is to work harder to earn more money to buy more things. And, the most precious thing we have is time. Yeah. So when you're giving up the time and, the work-life balance to accumulate more and more possessions, then that really is folly.
It reminds me of Citizen Kane, the movie, and at the end he says Rosebud, and there's several interpretations, but one interpretation is that, he spent his life buying stuff. And Rosebud was the sled that he didn't have from his childhood. You know, but I tend to think it's not about the possession. It's more about him hearkening back to his childhood. But still, it does ring, you know, it does have that ring because that character just had warehouses filled with things that he purchased that he probably only looked at once. You know, so this idea, like, I'm fascinated by all of this stuff you're talking about because I'm feeling it penetrate my life to a certain degree. Some of these things that you're talking about, like buying stuff on eBay, like finding these rare items that you can't get in stores anymore that someone has that you can, you know, you can find and get a good version of it. It's incredibly fun to get that eBay bug and do it. Then buying stuff that you just immediately don't use and you put on display, that's very rarely do you interact with it. You only interact with it with your eyes. You know, like I like to collect blasters, and like most of my blasters I just look at on a case. They're not even like in my hands, you know. And then that the gluttony of owning so much stuff that it has a physical weight on you. You know, you're just tied down to these objects. You're beholden to them in a weird kind of way. And I feel this way also about computer files.
Yeah. So it's really interesting. I mean, what you're saying about owning too much stuff. I think most garages in the US, and this is true in the UK, don't contain the household car. They contain the overflow of the house. So, you know, it's got to ridiculous states now, which we just – You are over-consuming things in a way which – actually, you know, we have to seriously question it now because I think we're being faced with some stark realities about the consequences of over-consumption. And, of course, this is changing. So the millennials, most of us are – at my age, we kind of have our houses and stuff like that. But for millennials, a lot of them are never going to be able to afford housing. And so they're not spending their money in the same way that we were 20 years ago. They're not trying to get on the property ladder. So they're spending it on experiences. So this is this big thing about investing in experiences as opposed to investing in property. Both, by the way, are dangerous for the climate. But the one thing about experiences is, unlike property, they become better with memory. So even though you might have a terrible holiday, with time, the thing actually wasn't bad after all. Whereas if you've bought something, it sits around and reminds you of gathering dust of how useless it is until you buy the next upgrade. But what you were saying about digital property, I think, is really interesting territory. And getting back to what I was talking about, that how do children understand who owns anything? That's a real fundamental problem of what is property, because this is why we have lawyers. Lawyers are there to establish a priori rights, who owns what. And it turns out it's a very complicated issue. Every law book has a section on property, but there's no universal definition of it. And that's what they're there for. They fight over it. And I don't know if you got a chance to look at it, but right at the beginning of the book, I talk about that really fascinating case about the guy who ends up buying a smoker grill at a secondhand sale. It opens it up and discovers there's a human foot in it, and it belongs to this guy who's still alive. And then they argue about who actually owns the foot. So these,
oh my God,
yeah. You think, well, there shouldn't be any question, but actually, you know, when you look at it legally, there are some interesting blind spots about what is property, who owns what. For example, you can't sell your kidneys in many countries. US, you can't sell your kidneys, and you can't sell them in the UK, but you can sell them in Singapore or Australia. So it's not like there's some universal law about what you can and cannot do with property. And I think this is increasingly going to become an issue as the digital era starts to come into our lives, because obviously some of the most valuable property now is information. And who owns that information? You know, when you download an app, you're effectively giving away that information to companies. So I think this, you know, really interesting territory about what is ownership, what is property, and what can you do with it?
Yeah, I think the relationship between, you know, wealth, ownership, and happiness is interesting. And it seems that, you know, just reading, you know, your book and reviews of your book, it's become more nuanced with more research. So, yeah, money doesn't make you happy, but being poor makes you unhappy. And so the extent to which money makes you not poor, it does contribute to your happiness. But then at some point, once you're beyond the not poor level, it doesn't necessarily make you happier, but there's this thing called life satisfaction, which is distinct from happiness. It does make you more satisfied with yourself and your life, if not more happy. And how do you parse those two things? It's hard. That seems really subtle.
And actually, and a lot of entrepreneurship and a lot of determination to succeed is not financially driven. I mean, it might be initially financially driven, but then it becomes almost, the competition factor I was talking about.
Yeah.
And the money becomes almost, irrelevant. There are many people in Silicon Valley. Steve Jobs famously lived a very simple life. He wasn't really into the cars. He had no furniture. For him, it was the status of Apple, and it was all the things that he pursued. So, certainly I'm not advocating that we should get rid of incentives. And, having the nice trappings in life are great. And as Mae West said, I've been rich, I've been poor. Believe me, rich is better. I don't think anyone's arguing with that. But it's when it starts to become toxic to your life and toxic to your family and toxic to your planet, that's when you have to stop and say, hold a second, whoa, what are we doing here? That it's a relentless pursuit of materialism is what we've got to question. I'm all for status. I'm all for rewarding people for their efforts. But I think we've been told that those rewards are in the form of material things. And I think that's a very shallow way of thinking about it. There are other things which I think we can aspire to, or at least that's what I'd like to believe.
Yeah. So we should stop thinking of them as a means unto themselves and just think about what are we investing to get that thing? What does it really do for us? Think about it in a more rational way, because we're inherently maybe not rational. I want to just to summarize one thing, though, just the psychology of valuing things. So it seems like there's two components that are necessary. You need to see stuff as an extension of yourself.
Yeah.
And you need to have a positive regard of yourself, right? So the more you think about your own value, the more you'll value the stuff that you own, if you look at the stuff that you own as an extension of yourself.
Yeah. There's some research showing that's indeed true. So the endowment effect is correlated with your self-image. So if you've got a very poor self-image, then you don't sort of think of your stuff as...
So do narcissists like really overvalue their own stuff?
That's a study which hasn't been done as far as I'm aware, but I would not be surprised to find that is true. They typically love pictures of themselves. And, famously, I do talk about a certain president.
Kind of a natural experiment that we're doing, huh?
Yeah. who believes that his success is definitely by his material displays or social peacocking, as I say. There's a great story that Bill Gates tells that apparently from his daughter, and I hope I don't get sued for this, but apparently he used to film these events, these writing events in Florida, and he was talking to Bill Gates' daughter, and then he disappeared for 15 minutes, and then suddenly this helicopter arrives, and it's Trump. And what he had done, obviously, is he had left the meeting early so he could go and get into a helicopter so he could make a big entrance, which I think is absolutely hilarious. And I draw the analogy with a poor farmer in India who does exactly the same thing. He suddenly gets a windfall of money, and he spends a huge amount of money to fly his son to his wedding by helicopter. And, it's really the same thing, effectively, is displaying your status to others through your exuberant displays of wealth. And there's good reasons for that. And it's because, we compete. And that's why, by the way, why bling and, this sort of ostentatious jewelry is much more common in certain communities and not others. It's in those communities where the competition is more fierce that there's a greater need to show status by these overt displays. But if there isn't that degree of competition, then you don't see such overt ostentatious spending of wealth. And different cultures differ. So I talk about the Nordic countries. I have I currently have a Norwegian student, and I learned so much from her about what was considered acceptable displays of wealth and boasting and so on. And they have quite strict laws about they're not explicit laws. They have a thing called the law yanta, which are these principles by which they're supposed to live, which is not to show hubris, but to be kind of more balanced. And they actively discourage that in their children from a very early age. So I think it's really interesting, the Nordic view of this way of living. And by the way, the Nordic countries are some of the happiest countries in the world on all these principles.
Right, although it's hard to draw a direct cause and effect there. But yeah, it's interesting. So, but at least possessions are not a necessary condition for happiness. And I think that gets back to sort of the original point of it's really a proxy for something else. And if in your culture, being humble is what gets you social status, then that's what you do.
Yes. Right? Yes. That's exactly it. So, yeah, so it can manifest in different ways. I think we've all got the same brain on the planet. It's not as if our brains are different. It's just how they have been enculturated to be accepted. And in societies which were forged by entrepreneurship and frontier spirits, it was a clear sense of determination and the need to succeed that forged that very independent way of thinking. And that's what you find typically in Western cultures. So that's not necessarily a brain difference, but that's something that we teach our children from a very early age, which is good news because, you know, we do have to do something. We have to change, and we're not about to suddenly abandon all of our kind of desires for luxury and unique things. But eventually we're going to have to figure out that actually, you know, we're not going anywhere quickly on this planet. And we do have to start thinking about the consequences, especially when you've got about over 2 billion people in poverty in China and India. And they're going to want a level of comfort that the rest of us enjoy. So we've got to figure out how do we balance that? How do we square that with the fact we've got limited resources? So we do need to change. We can change, but it requires some real sort of, I think, in the West, thinking about what it is we really want. Because we blindly have just been going on overproducing and overconsuming, assuming that it's never going to end. But the reality is it will at some point. And what I find remarkable is that, you know, we would die for our children, but we seem to not think about the consequences for our children's children, like 3 generations on. So we've got very limited ability to see into the future. And we can certainly care for our immediate children, but somehow once you get into 3 generations away, it just seems to be someone else's problem.
Right, too remote.
So, Bruce, if I buy your book, will you come to my house and take all the crap out of it for me?
Oh, yeah, I'm not Marie Kondo. I say to spark joy in you. it's kind of funny. Actually, it's interesting that a number of the reviewers have said, well, look, you haven't said anything I don't disagree with entirely, but you haven't provided me with an answer. You know, what do I need to do? And I haven't got a solution. All I've got to say is that just ask yourself, do you really need to be buying that next thing? Or do you really need that? And I think actually, paradoxically, that actually might make you appreciate what you've got more, in the sense that if you just don't think it, we're on autopilot a lot of the time, you think about it. We tend to buy things because we just think, oh, well, I can't afford it. Well, you know, I can do this. Why not? But I think if we start to question, what is the motivation? Am I doing this because my neighbor's got... they've just bought a new car. If we start to ask those sorts of questions, I think we become more mindful, to use that dreadful term, of what actually is the motivation for doing things. And I think that can only be a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. That's metacognition. It's the same that we are always talking about. It's a difference between being on autopilot, just going along with your culture and your evolved biases, versus actually getting outside yourself and thinking about, is this rational? Does this really help me? And the people who can do that, like traders who divorce themselves from their emotions and just do things rationally, they have an advantage over you in any kind of transactional exchange because they're not just going with the flow of their psychology.
Absolutely. I think you put it beautifully. I mean, metacognition, not only is it a better way to live, I think it actually bestows benefits to you become more appreciative, more grateful for what you've got. And I think, I mean, I teach this course, The Science of Happiness, here at Bristol. And this is what I'm doing in a lot of that course is basic cognitive psychology, just getting them to kind of really, stop being on that autopilot, as you put it, and actually start to evaluate things, be more critical. I mean, I think critical thinking is really important for happiness. People think, oh, critical thinking, you'll just be miserable. Well, not really. No, I think it's liberating. I think it provides a different viewpoint. It means you're more appreciative of the positive things in life, and you're probably going to be more satisfied in many instances. And I think you could apply that to consumerism and the way that we buy stuff and seem to have this need to have possessions. Because we are really the only species on the planet that does this. I mean, yes, other animals have tools, but they throw them away once they've used them. We, on the other hand, build sheds to hold all the tools and then put them on display and then collect them by alphabetical order and so on. So we have this really strange relationship with physical things.
Bruce, it's a fascinating book and a fascinating talk. Thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it.
I really enjoy it. Can't wait to see you guys again.
Yep. Thanks, Bruce. Take care. We'll see you soon, man.
Bye. All right.
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.